Hello and welcome to Escape from Lockdown, the show all about how we got into this madness and how we're gonna get out of it. Now, this episode is a little bit special because you might hear a little bit more background noise today because I'm presenting it from a German, a Westphalian beer garden right next to the Rhine. I've got wooded hills ahead of me on the other side, the banks of the river. I have Germans cycling past, the sun is glistening on the waters of the river. It's absolutely fantastic. And I'm doing this today because I kind of thought I want to travel into the future or the past, depending on how you want to frame it, and give you an impression of a time when there were pubs. And hopefully it's a time we will one day get back to. Now, my guest today is a very special guy. He's a guy I met a while ago, and I've also got to know him on Twitter. He is one of the Third Wednesday crew for all of Dick Dellingpole's followers out there. He's a compiler of lists, an issuer of school reports. He's the all-seeing eye, the Knight of the Garter, Squire of Soundness, Sir Dan of Sea. Dan, how you doing, mate? Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Well, what a wonderful introduction. That's very kind of you. It's a pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me.
Oh, well, thanks for coming on. So before we start on anything, which we're going to talk about this in quite detail later on the show, you've become something of a sort of Twitter celebrity by virtue of these school reports. Can you tell us a little bit about them and how you got into doing them?
Yes, of course. It's a good question. So I think the background to this is going back to the start of this this whole coronavirus lockdown period that we're in, and I lose track of how many weeks ago that this was, but around the time that you know, there was a lot of talk in the media about where this was going to end up, and you know, probably at that point in time it was as much about the fear of how potent and dangerous the virus was as much as anything else. You know, there was so much, let's say, bedwetting out there, that I happened to make the comment on Twitter, I think, that I was trying to view this whole thing a bit like a school, where you had a headmaster there, and okay, maybe you can forgive the odd comment here and there, but broadly speaking, I wanted to come out of it, you know, with maybe receiving a bit of a telling off here and there, maybe some lines, but you know, there would be some people you know, gonna get a damn good thrashing off the headmaster or words to that effect. And I can actually blame James Dellingpole for encouraging me to create and compile a list of the worst offenders, and that's what I did. So I came up with the first list, and like a lot of things that I do, I just chucked it into an Excel spreadsheet, selected a range of people who are vocal on Twitter, whether they are you know, blue tick broadcast journalists, whether they are people from different fields, different walks of life, and then some of the sort of Twitter celebrities. And I sort of gave them a cuck score, that is to say, whether they were at the one end of the extreme, sort of 10 being, you know, the world's going to end tomorrow. It's a whole, you know, it's a huge disaster, end of the world, and one being, you know, absolutely sound. And I put that list together. I can't remember how many people were on there, because it's that long ago, and shared it out, and it went down quite well, and from there it's been added to, it's been iterated, I've had suggestions, people have questioned some of the scores, although I have to say the scores are not really the fun part. The fun part is the the comments, the notes that I put on there. And yeah, it's grown from there, and there's quite a few people now who enjoy being on there. They message me, you know, they make suggestions, and it's created a bit of entertainment, I think, in what otherwise has been not the greatest period in our recent times.
I think what you do serves quite a social purpose, actually, because as far as the mainstream media concerned, it just leaves me bereft. You know, politically, there's no opposition to this. You know, Keir Starmer, lobby journalists are sort of wetting themselves about Keir Starmer, saying, "No, he's finally Labour have got somebody holding the government to account." No, they don't. He's not doing any of that. He's not questioning anything. He's not looking at the science or you know, looking at other scientific viewpoints. He's not looking at how other countries are working, unless it's to sort of encourage more lockdown. The only opposition is more lockdown. Yeah. And it's really only in Twitter that you can come out and find these voices. And my God, I found some brilliant people during this. Some people I'd already met before and I didn't realise how brilliant they were. Hector Drummond, I'm looking at you right now. And it kind of grounds me. In moments of wobbliness, it's really wonderful to have a look at it and remind ourselves just how strong some of our finest members can be. And on a secondary point, this is something that James has discussed a lot and Toby has discussed a lot. I think they talked about a lot in their latest London Calling, is how the people that we would expect to be completely solid on this issue turn out to be a total bedwetting cuck. And the battle lines that were so squarely drawn after the Brexit fight have just completely evaporated. And some of what we thought were our finest Brexiteers have absolutely fallen apart into a soggy mattress of cuckery. And some, you know, red-blooded Remainers have actually turned out to be incredibly sound on this issue. So it's been a really, really great thing. And I always turn to it when you release your reports. And later on in the show, well, quite shortly, we're actually going to be talking about them in a bit more detail, because I think it's time for speech day. And I think it's time for some prizes and some expulsions to be read out in front of the school. But before we do that, I just want to talk about how you've branched out into a bit of writing yourself. Can you tell me, and I hope you don't mind me saying, but you know, you're part of that Third Wednesday crew, which is a wonderful thing that Dick has sort of developed around the Worcester area and wider afield too. And can you, actually, if you could explain that to me first, how you sort of got to know Dick and all those guys and your sort of monthly drinks and all of that, and how you got into that. And then after that, how you decided, because you work in sort of internet business, basically, how you decided to branch out into writing, and you wrote a wonderful article for Hector Drummond about fear. So tell us how both of those things happened.
Yeah, of course. Just to touch on the point that you made about, you know, those people who were, you know, we previously thought were sound. I one observation I've had on that is that, you know, Brexit was a topic that, of course, ran for many, many years before, the referendum of 2016. I mean, for some people, it went for, perhaps 20 years. And that meant, you know, 10, 20 years of building up arguments and multiple reasons for being in favour of leaving the EU. And I think what happened was that, you know, everybody had got their house in order on that particular topic. And you ended up with a sort of strange alliance of people from various different places, some on the right, some on the left, many sort of libertarians. And, you know, that meant that there was a sort of strength in union, whereas this current coronavirus situation has taken everybody by surprise. And therefore, what we're seeing is, you know, people's natural reaction. And in many cases, that involves a sort of panic and you know, an absence of critical thought. So, but yes, you mentioned Worcester Libertarians. So that probably goes back 12 months, I would imagine. I lose track of time now. But I'd been following Dick Dellingpole on Twitter for some time, and was a fan of the podcast that he did with James. I'd followed James through his various writings and his appearances in the media, and Dick reached out. I think actually Dick tweeted at some point that he was looking to do a drinks meet for people who were loosely in the Midlands who could make it to Worcester, and would you be interested? And I replied to that, and I was obviously one of a number. And anyway, he arranged for us on a particular date last year to meet at the one of the Wetherspoons pubs in Worcester. And it's not far for me to go. I went to school in Worcester. I don't live there now, but I'm probably about 40 minutes away, so it wasn't difficult for me to get there. I arrived. There was a lot of people who were sort of hanging around the bar, looking like they were probably there for the same reason. and then Dick walked in, and the great thing about Dick is that he's so easy to spot. If you know what he looks like, there's not many people who wear a beret out and about and have they sport a huge handlebar moustache. So he walked through the door, and we all sort of said hello, and it was great, because of course on Twitter you have people who are they're completely transparent. You know, Joe Bloggs, and there's a picture of Joe Bloggs, and if you were to meet Joe Bloggs, there wouldn't be a surprise there. But of course a lot of people go via a different name, a pseudonym, or something completely different, and he'd actually printed out badges for everybody, so you could see their Twitter handle stuck to their chest, and you were having conversations with people in real life who you might have had interaction with on Twitter for several months, in some case perhaps years, and it was just a fantastic idea. It worked really well. We sort of decided collectively that it once a month would be good. It so fell on the third Wednesday, and so third Wednesday became a thing. And there's probably probably 10 or 12 let's say regulars who were there at almost all of the meetings. I say regulars. I mean, of course it's suspended right now because UK at least we can't go to a pub or a bar, but
it was so good
up until a couple of months ago. We were meeting regularly, and I've got to know some fantastic people. We have a WhatsApp group, so we're in the last few weeks we've been in regular communication. I mean, we're chatting away throughout the day, it's not just been third Wednesday. I mean, there's been some other things happen as well. I mean, back in the autumn last year, for example, James did he did podcast live, so that was an event down in London with various other people there. I mean, Rod Little and Brendan O'Neill were there.
It was terrific, wasn't it? It was just so great. And Dick and James had Dominic Frisbee come on and do a song in their podcast, and
yes,
the Brendan and Rod podcast they did was just fantastic. It was. I spoke to Brendan afterwards, and he was saying that neither of them sort of covered any particular new ground. It was more like when you go see Robert Plant, you want to see the Led Zeppelin hits, you know?
Yeah.
You want to see the classics. So they didn't. So they were happy not to sort of explore too much new material, but just go through the solid things for the crowd. And it was just. It's a great idea. The podcast live thing. I hope that one day maybe we can help out in organizing a kind of sound version where there's only cool podcasts that you'd actually like to listen to are on, because that would be brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely. So it was things like that have come along the way, and it's a great idea, and as I say, you know, we meet new people every month. I mean, it's great to meet people who we read about it, or we read their articles, and we see them online. It's great to go and meet people like that, but equally You know, I think Dick's connected a lot of people. And, you know, we've got to I mean, this is the thing about social media now. I mean, you know, people have been critical about spending time online and you know, on the likes of Twitter. But, you know, if you can actually meet like-minded people that way. And when I say like-minded people, I mean, what you find with Third Wednesday is that it's not as if you have, you know, a whole row of people there who are of exactly the same opinions. I mean, there are some people there who are lefties, some people who would regard themselves as Tories, conservatives, some people who would be more kind of the sort of Brexit party, some people who are probably not remotely interested in politics. They just you know, that they just have a sort of general sort of libertarian view in life, that they want to just do what they want to do without feeling like, you know, that they need to be told what to do and think. So there's all sorts of different people. And it's yeah, I'm glad he did it. And and you know, someone like Hector, for example, who has been, you know, we'll talk about the school report and the list. I mean, Hector is currently regarded as head boy in the list for his work on.
Absolutely fantastic, Hector. What a hero.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and I've met Hector a few times, and he really is a lovely guy in real life. So, I think it's, you know, it's important to have these things. I mean, now more than ever, of course, we need to remind ourselves that there is actually a real world out there where people, yes, don't just type on an iPhone or a computer. We actually do go and meet in real life and have proper conversations. So, yeah, that's I guess the story behind Third Wednesday. And
I'll just say now, because I know that Dick, and I love Dick, and if I Dick might be weirded out by this, but if I could swap lives with anybody, it would be Dick, because he lives in a beautiful town, he's got a lovely family, he does a job that he loves, and he still gets to do all the things that he likes to do, like his art and all of that stuff. He's like, you know, this idea in Taoism about like this kind of being at peace with your situation. And he tweeted once, even if he was a millionaire, he wouldn't do his Sundays any different. He'd go read his paper, walk the dogs, get some coffee, have a walk. It's just perfect. And Dick is very keen to expand this nationally. I know that Thor Holt is interested in starting up in Aberdeenshire, where he is. I'm in London. I'm really useless with organising stuff, and my job often means I have to cancel shit at last minute, so I'm not sure I'd be the best person to sort of funnel that thing, but I'm very keen for it to start up there. And, you know, to all our listeners, wherever the hell you are, I mean, even if you're in Canada or America or Australia, wherever, or even just in the southwest in Wales, just do it. Start it up and, you know, get the movement going. It'll be fantastic. So yeah, I just interrupted you there, but I think you were going to talk about your article for Hector's blog. So can you tell us a little bit about how you decided to do that, and how and what it was about?
Sure, yeah. Well, I've my job is, as I say, sales and marketing. I have a background in e-commerce, but I've always been writing things, and there's been the odd article here and there, and I think in this last period, I've not felt particularly motivated to write articles about the coronavirus situation for several reasons, partly because the list has been taking up quite a bit of time, particularly as it's morphed into several lists, and there's a lot of comments and feedback. But I think as well that you know, a lot of the bases have been covered. People like Hector, and you know, those who are doing particularly well on the list, I mean, people like Peter Hitchens, Toby Young particularly, and of course James have written extensively about the situation, and You know, I kind of felt that, you know, my opinion was sort of contained in what they were doing. But I think when I submitted the piece to Hector, which was really something around the concept of fear, it was motivated by an exchange I had on Facebook. I tend to stay clear a little bit of steer clear of Facebook, because ordinarily it's people that you know, it's sort of close friends and family, that sort of thing, and I try and avoid you know, controversial things across Facebook. But I'd seen such a huge amount of I guess you could call it, you know, mawkish virtue signaling, you know, pro-lockdown sort of stuff being shared. I thought, you know what, I'm just going to throw something just to create a little bit of controversy and throw a bit of a curveball. And I posted a stat on there about the chances of dying from coronavirus being so high if you're age 15 or under. And I got a lot of bite back on that, as I expected. But some of the comments were so absurd that I kind of reflected on it. And I put the piece together. I thought, I'm going to send this to Hector. And essentially, the point that I was trying to make was that, you know, over a long time now, over a long period of time, probably decades, the state has got more and more involved with trying to keep us safe, in inverted commas.
Yes.
And I don't think many people have asked for that, but, you know, nevertheless, it's still decided to do that. And it's kind of like I think Peter Hitchens would describe it as salami slicing. You know, each act, each piece of regulation, each law is done in the most minor way possible, that you either don't notice, or if you do notice it, you can't possibly quibble, because you're seen to be making a mountain out of a molehill. But what happens is, over a period of time, it builds up and builds up, and you end up with this nanny state. That's a cliche. I don't particularly like it, but that, you know, everyone knows what I mean by that. But my hope and expectation was that, given that we have a prime minister who is quite gregarious and optimistic, and people seem to think that he had some libertarian tendencies, and then, you know, coupled with the fact that we were supposed to be leaving the EU, and the EU has obviously been an extra level of bureaucracy and regulation, perhaps, you know, that whole process would slow down, and maybe you know, we wouldn't go back to, you know, 50 years ago. I don't think that's going to happen, but we would perhaps slow this sort of cycle of nanny statism. And I think what's concerning to me is this coronavirus phase that we're going through now has sort of almost put it into hyperspeed, and we've now got shot forward to the point where we don't really need the state to turn us into you know, a country of namby-pambies. You know, we're now fearful of everything. And you know, some of the comments that I'm seeing just make me wonder what it's going to take to go back to what I might regard as being normal. You know, the problem is, of course, is that we haven't really examined our life choices. And by the way, the Facebook thing was done around the time that the schools question was kicking off. So this they'd announced that I think year one and year six were going to return to school early June, and of course there was a lot of pushback from teachers, from unions, and then from parents as well. But of course, we're looking at everything now through the lens of illness and disease and infection and the health implication of that. But we've never really done that before. You know, we've never really done that with, you know, let's say normal flu or illnesses that have come and gone. And had we have done that, I mean, probably we would have never sent children to school. We would have never walked outside our front door. It just seems that all sense of balance has has disappeared, and the concept of risk now comes into just about every single life choice, whether it's sending your children back to school, whether it's deciding to go to the shops or the supermarket. Most crazily of all, even to get into your own car, which, there are many reasons for thinking that a car, it might be unsafe, but catching coronavirus doesn't seem like a particularly good one. So that was really the reason for me contributing to Hector's webpage. And I guess that was my angle on it. And I do worry really where we're going to be as a society when we come out the other side of this. I don't think it's going to be the same as it was before, and I think it's a real shame, and particularly for children, because I mean, at least you can argue with adults that they had a before and an after, whereas, you know, children, I mean, I have two young children. One is six, the other is nine, and of course a period of 2, 3, 4, 6 months for a six-year-old, for a nine-year-old, I mean, it's like their entire life, right? They don't, you know, they don't have as much experience to draw on, and therefore, you know, the balance isn't quite there as it would be for adults. So, that was the idea really behind the piece for Hector.
It's a great subject, Fia, because it's something that I felt really reared its head in the post 9/11 world. And I'm speaking as someone who, you know, 9/11 caused me to go and do Arabic at university, and I got very much into Middle Eastern politics and the study of terrorism and things like that, and radical Islamic politics. And I realized fairly early on, I think it was in the sort of aftermath of Iraq really, that what we were doing was just nuts. And all our kind of policies were, you know, dealing with a problem that ultimately we'd make this situation worse with our heavy-handedness. But at the same time, we were terrorizing the population to be fearful of terror attacks, when in reality, the chances of being killed in a terror attack is infinitesimally small. But at the same time, even though it's important, and radical Islamic politics is certainly something that we need to watch out for, but I would argue that the much more insidious forms of that are when it gets institutionalized and when they use institutional means to get their way. So I'm recording this from Germany. You know, we don't need to be reminded of how, when Hitler was just trying to do coups and stuff like that, he wasn't getting anywhere. But when he got into the political system, that's when it got incredibly dangerous, incredibly quickly. If you've not seen it, or for our listeners as well, Adam Curtis is a brilliant documentary maker who constructs films out of archive, made a film, I think around 2003-04, called The Power of Nightmares. And it's really, really worth watching now, because he makes the point that in the sort of post-war years, our politicians sold themselves to us on the basis of being able to fulfill our dreams. But that has changed, and now they're selling themselves to us so they can protect us from nightmares. And my God, if that is not happening right now, then I do not know what is. Could I move on to the second? I think the part of the podcast that all our listeners will be very eager to hear. Speech day. So I think it's time to go through some of the school reports. So I'm going to try and pull them up here. Now, you very kindly sent me the most up-to-date reports. So can we start with, because it's worth saying, even though it's less interesting, the MP's reports. Now, tell me sort of broadly how you drew these up, and because there's different things you were talking about as well, about how you've got the whole new intake and their kind of take is a bit different, and how you've weighted it as well. So the MPs who have more power, i.e. cabinet ministers, etc., junior ministers, their actions will affect their score much more greatly.
Yeah, so the MPs report is a little bit different, I would say, to the main sort of good bad war report, in that I've tried to keep it a little bit less frivolous and tried to be a little bit kinder. I wanted it to be the sort of thing that an MP would read and perhaps not just disregard altogether. But firstly, it took some assembling. I mean, there's 365 Tory MPs right now, thanks to the last election, and not all of them are on Twitter, and those who are on Twitter, many of them don't really engage much. I think that there's a few points that I would make. I mean, firstly, there were over 100 newly elected MPs in the recent election, and a lot of them were elected in the what they call the Red War constituencies. So that's, typically kind of old school Labour, kind of maybe you call it blue collar Labour. And Brexit was the big theme of the day. And I think what we're seeing among those MPs is probably the downside of what happened in Parliament between 2016 and 2019, which is that in that era, and particularly the Theresa May period after she lost her majority, because the Conservative Party couldn't keep their MPs on topic. I mean, they were essentially doing whatever they wanted to do from a voting perspective, and outside the Commons they were sort of going completely off message, that it meant that whatever majority they had, and they didn't really have one at all, it counted for nothing. And I think that there's been such a concerted effort to try and get that back in place that it's served Brexit well, but it hasn't served anything else, because they are very much the mouthpiece of whatever the government line is. And I'm seeing that on Twitter. All they're doing is regurgitating, the usual stay at home hashtags, the usual messaging, and they're effectively acting in a very authoritarian way. But I can't really I can't really gauge what their actual opinion is. So that's kind of one side of it. Of course, the cabinet, probably the worst scores actually are reserved for cabinet members, as you would imagine. Most of them are a 10. And I think the sad thing for myself, and I think a lot of, the sort of red meat conservative people would agree with this, is that there are people in there who we thought would be really, really sound on these sorts of topics.
My goodness,
people like Dominic,
yes.
Raab, people like Priti Patel, to a lesser extent Michael Gove, and of course Boris himself. And either they have totally melted and their own principles have just fallen away, or they don't have much influence, or they're just guilty of cowardice, or a combination of all three. But
well, you wonder if they have a very powerful whipping operation going on. So we haven't talked about it, and I think it's probably best if we don't, because it's been talked about way too much. But the Dominic Cummings business, for overseas listeners, Dominic Cummings is the Prime Minister's main advisor. He took a 200-mile trip when his wife had COVID, so that the kids could be looked after by his parents, and that's about it. But you'd think it was kind of like when Diana died in terms of coverage. Oh my word, it's just insane. And it seems very clear to me that all of the Tory MPs have been told you must tweet out in support of Dominic because it kind of ties them to him and vis-a-vis government policy. And after Brexit, I think the one thing that was very clear that May lacked was a complete lack of control over party discipline. And you know, many MPs, you know, some standout idiots like Rory Stewart or Amber Rudd, who were just sort of going completely against what they'd been elected for and suffering no consequence. And you know, when Boris came in, it, you know, new game was in town and they had to be much more strict, and they've applied that to this, which kind of says something about the MPs who have stood up and said, no, you know, I don't believe this is the case. So I think, I mean, we're not going to spend too much time going for all of them. So let's just pick up a couple of heroes and a couple of villains. So let's say villains first. Is there one or two MPs for you who just really stand out as just, oh my God, have they really disappointed you? Or have they been people who've just been, you know, Piers Morgans in Parliament?
I think looking at the villains, I think in the list, the approach that I took was that, you know, I'm going to cut some slack to the new intake on the basis that, you know, we don't really know what their sort of past history is, particularly, you know, younger MPs. And at the same time, those who have been in Parliament for quite some time, you know, I think that it's easier to really get a gauge for what they stand for as Conservatives. And also you'd expect a little bit more backbone anyway. And I think on that basis, you know, some of those who have been around for quite some time, particularly some of the Remain voters who held their seat, who may have had cabinet jobs sort of over the last few years. So somebody, for example, like Brandon Lewis, he would be quite a good example. You know, they really have been the worst in this, and it kind of tells me that you know, that there really is still a big part of the Conservative Party who you could argue would be just as happy in the Lib Dems, or possibly even a Labour Party if it was a little bit more centrist as it was. And I think on the other side, you know, as you say, you know, I think it's important to give credit to those who have stood out. And the most obvious example is Steve Baker.
Steve Baker. I call him Aragorn. If there's one man who's just been consistently brilliant on all of this, it's been Steve. And can you remember the speech he gave when the Coronavirus Act came through? And he said, look, I'm really not happy about this at all.
That was at the start in Parliament, and he got emotional. Yeah.
But you can see how, you know, at the very beginning, I think a lot of us kind of thought, OK, well, look, we can get behind this for 3 weeks and then let's get out of it as soon as we possibly can. And remember at the time, you know, we didn't know quite as much as we did now, or as we do now. But my goodness, he has passed this test with flying colours.
He absolutely has, yes. And you know, I see a lot of people calling for him to be the next leader. And a lot of people, you know, were backing him a year ago when obviously they were going forward into a potential leadership challenge. But I don't know. I think the issue is with people like him is that, you know, he's almost too pure to come through the process. I think it's quite a grim machine, the Conservative Party, the sort of machine behind it. And you need you need certain characteristics, I think, to make it to the top. And I think he might struggle, but he's been absolutely fantastic. I think Lucy Allen as well has been very good. Owen Paterson is another one who springs to mind, who's been decent. There are quite a number, and this is the same of all the various lists and school reports. There's been quite a number who flip-flop quite a bit. They'll come out on one particular topic, and you think, yeah, okay, this is quite promising, and then it's almost like they'll shrink back below the parapet, and they don't really want any more adverse publicity. I hear from various sources that there's a lot of MPs who are getting a lot of pressure from local businesses, who are basically saying, look, if this continues, we are not going to be able to open back up. Never mind the all the different financial and furlough schemes that you've operated. We're just not going to be able to open up. And they're privately trying to relay these messages, but of course in public they're under pressure to toe the party line, whatever that happens to mean, and essentially on Twitter it means sharing the hashtags, sharing the videos of nurses dancing in empty hospitals and whatever else it may be. So yes, it was quite a stark and depressing exercise to go through all of these MPs, I have to say.
Well, and I think I'm sorry. I think it will continue to be depressing, but it's worth doing because we really need to know what our representatives, who are supposed to be representing us, are actually thinking. But let's go on to the good stuff, the fun stuff now. It's speech day, so prizes. We have had some wonderful fighters in our cause. So, to go through some on your list, let's give James a run out, good old James, because in some ways I feel this podcast is almost a child of the Delling Pod, because I work with James a little bit on some of the Delling Pods, and you got involved in things with Dick. So I think James has been brilliant, absolutely fantastic.
I think James has been absolutely sound on this, and I think I also have to give him some credit for encouraging me into to moving this whole thing along. So yes, he has to be somewhere up there, I would agree.
Oh, terrific. Okay, Alison Pearson. Now, she has been, she's always brilliant, but I think she's been extra good with this. What's your review of Alison Pearson
Well,
then?
Alison, I think is she would have the award for the most improved pupil, I think, at the school awards. I mean, she started out a little bit wobbly, I have to say, but she's been superb over the last few weeks, particularly breaking down the elements of coming out of the lockdown, the real issues rather than the pretend issues. And I think as well, one thing I have noticed in doing this is the sheer level of abuse that some people get on Twitter when you get caught up in these various threads, and you see, you get a little eye opener into the vitriol that people get for airing their views. She gets it, and she sticks to her point. So yeah, absolutely super job, and she's definitely on the podium for an award.
We have to have a most consistent award, so that's got to go to the person who's been there right from the beginning. And that has to be the one and only Peter Hitchens.
Yes, Peter Hitchens—he's an interesting one, isn't he? Because he—I think because of his manner, and possibly his background, he isn't the most, he isn't the person that a lot of people warm to, a little bit. I think James describes it as, you wouldn't want to be stuck in a foxhole with him necessarily, but, yeah, he's been absolutely consistent from the outset. He, of course, believes in the rule of law. He's, you know, been quite vocal in saying that he would never do anything that would break the law or the regulations. But
you've actually docked him half a point for that.
Yes.
On your list.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. being too obedient, yeah, docks you half a point. But okay. But there
so
again,
you can't be too much of a teacher's pet in this.
Yeah, he's kind of sticking to his core principles, but he's been fantastic in very much his own way. I think Toby Young should have a lot of credit because
I think Toby Young deserves a prize. What should we give him? So extracurricular, maybe. I just think Lockdown Skeptics is absolutely terrific. It's always just such a great read, you know. I often find myself reading it before bed or in the morning or something. And even if it's annoying because I'll be on my way to do something and I think, oh, I'll just have a quick look at Lockdown Skeptic, you know, and I'm just stuck because they're getting bigger and bigger. And it's just such a great resource, isn't it? So, you know, what do you think for Toby? Extracurricular, or can you think of another prize he should be getting?
Well, he's been fantastic, and the amount of work, by the way, that he's put into that site is quite phenomenal. Well, I think he's, I mean, essentially he's lost his cuck badge. I think that's the prize, and that's probably a prize that James would be quite annoyed about, given their sparring on the London Calling pod. But no, he's definitely deserved it.
I think. Shall we have a? Actually, I want to mention a couple of people. So, one person that I've been very impressed with, who's kind of sort of veered all over the place, has been Andrew Lillico. Do you follow Andrew?
Well, he's one that I followed a little bit, and probably falls into the category of people who I tend to get more comments about. In other words, I'm reliant a little bit on people saying, oh, actually, you know, you've given him this score, it should be another score. And I think that's been the difficulty with this, that there are people who have gone a bit up and down. And depending upon the point at which I've looked at it, it's not necessarily an accurate reflection of the whole period.
Let me tell you what Andrew deserves extra credit. And it's because Andrew still, to some extent, and I really don't want to be putting words into his mouth because I'd love to have him on this at some point. He's made a few statements kind of supporting some of the more kind of worst case predictions. Now, you and I, we both know that the modelling and all of that is bollocks, and evidence is mounting every day that this apocalyptic death toll, you know, it's not going to be in the hundreds of thousands. Yeah. But Andrew is saying, even if it is 100,000, we should still end the lockdown because I have a, you know, well, I do have a son, but he has a son. And we can't say to his child that you can't do rugby or go dancing or go to university or have a job meeting people. And you know, and I think that deserves a special mention because he has looked at this from first principles and is saying that even if the death toll might be larger, the human loss could be a lot greater. And so in terms of sticking to your guns, admittedly, he has veered a little bit. Initially, it was terror. You know, he was writing a lot about having to go through pneumonia at home. And I think he bought himself some Mountaineer's oxygen, preparing for that eventuality, which, as you and I both know, would not have happened and is not going to happen.
Yeah.
But, you know, fair play to the man. Like, he you know, believes in this heightened level of danger and believes that running that risk is a price to pay for a civilized society. So, full marks to him.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So, there's a couple of people who have been a bit absent during this. Douglas Murray, I don't know, where's he been? Julia Hartley Brewer, I think you tweeted something about her today. Has your opinion on her changed somewhat? Or
Julia Hartley Brewer, she's definitely been one who's been up and down, and I think that probably, you know, if you again, go back to the whole Brexit period. You know, she's probably come out of that, and for a lot of people, it would be very, very difficult to pinpoint Julia in terms of what she stands for outside of Brexit, because everything's been through the lens of Brexit. And you know, I've seen tweets that she's posted, and various, I mean, she obviously has her radio show, various comments that she's made that I've thought, well, yeah, okay, that's pretty good. You know, she's picked up on a point and challenged some consensus. And then at other times, you know, she's just been all over the place and often quite bad. So she's probably the biggest sort of up and down right now. I would have to say it's down. It's not particularly great.
Okay. Sorry,
and
Julia.
I think there's definitely an absence of critical thinking on her part, or at least for that. That's from what I see. I think you know, talking about disappointing people, Andrew Neil.
Oh my goodness.
I think has been really poor throughout this. Seems to her. I mean, I think in the last sort of 24, 48 hours, with the whole Dominic Cummings media flare up, you know, he seems to be like the you know, the old guy in the corner of the bar who's sort of looking on, telling everybody that it was better in his day, he could do a lot better, and you know, he's just sort of a bit of a grumpy guy who doesn't really contribute a lot except to stoke up a lot of fear. So I think he's been a big disappointment as well.
Okay, I've got a few coming up rapid fire. So best teacher, there can be only one, right?
Best teacher.
There can be only one.
Well, who are you suggesting then?
Catherine Birbal Singh.
Yeah, as I said, I think in the last report, you know, her school will definitely open. And I think, again, you know, looking beyond coronavirus, you know, you're looking for people who are going to be consistently sound, whatever life throws at them, whatever the topic of the day. And, you know, she's somebody who doesn't look to the state to make all of her, you know, decisions and provide all the guidance. I think she's fantastic.
And she deserves extra points because you tweeted out this podcast. So four.
Oh, wow. OK,
her.
There you go. Well, I'm in that case. I think she might be on a two at the moment, in which case she has to go down to a one.
Oh, excellent. I'm very happy about that. I've got a couple more. Best lefty.
Best lefty. Wow, that's that's a difficult one. You know, talking about the awards ceremony, I had this idea that it would be quite a good opportunity to reclaim one of the institutions, something like Cambridge University, because of course they've closed down the campus for the next academic year, and it'd be nice to use that as a location for an awards ceremony. Of course, all the lefties would be outside protesting.
Yes.
They wouldn't want to come in. But I think someone like Michael Moore.
That's a curveball.
You know, bit left field. But, you know, I think you're looking for people on the left who are not afraid to not go along with the sort of crowds and the herd. You know, they're always a little bit, I guess the equivalent of a Peter Hitchens, you know, but of the left. So he would probably be there. I'm trying to think if there's anybody else.
Well, there's two main ones. So there's Paul Embury and Claire Fox.
Yes.
So between the two of them, both have been extremely sound in recent weeks. I don't know about you, but I think Claire Fox wins it.
Well, Claire Fox, I mean, I guess she was on the sound side of the report because of Brexit, and it's easy to forget that she is a lefty. And if you follow her closely on Twitter, occasionally she'll share an article, and you think, oh yes, okay, she was of the left. Yeah, she's been very good.
Okay, so one more before we get to head boy and head girl. The history prize. Actually, there are two more. We're going to do the history prize and the science prize. So the history prize, you know, so it's basically sort of best historian. We're looking at Tom Holland, Niall Ferguson, not the evil Niall Ferguson, and of course the great David Starkey. So who's going to get the history prize, do you think?
Yeah, well, I would say I give Tom Holland a lot of credit for flogging his books on Twitter. But I think having seen David Starkey, who's not on the list because I don't think he is on Twitter, he has done a few interviews recently. He did one with Peter Whittle. And it was fantastic. I mean, he is superb anyway. But I think to get the historical perspective of the topic of disease, it's a grim topic, but it's it's the theme of the day. But also, you know, he provided a lot of insight into how the government, came about their decision making process and the run up to the lockdown. It was really, really interesting. He's brilliant, so I would give it to David Starkey.
Right, David Starkey wins the history prize. The science prize. Now I know who I want to give this to. Who will you be giving the science prize to?
Well, I slightly shudder because, of course, you said the science prize, and that's the big thing. I think anybody who has not necessarily a scientific background, but who has scrutinised the data and the graphs and really tried to. Come to a sound conclusion. I mean, I would say that, I'd nominate someone like Hector from that perspective. Toby Young, obviously, as well, would be up there. I'm trying to think who else.
I want to jump in here and with my own nomination, and it is Sunetra Gupta, who is the epidemiologist from Oxford, who has produced a brilliant report and has basically been proven right. And I looked into her a bit. She's also a bit of a novelist who writes fiction in the kind of V.S. Naipaul kind of style. She wrote a book called Pandemic, and in principle I bought her book, and she has been totally brilliant because she's been saying from day one that this is, this is potentially pass through much of a population. We shouldn't be knocking people down. She was very critical of the Imperial report before anybody else was. And as you might know from Hector's blog, which got subsequently picked up by the media, she's been subject to disgusting smears about her personal life from the previous head of the Imperial team, Niall Ferguson's old boss. To which he was forced to publicly apologise. And she had a brilliant interview on Herd where she said, you know, we need to open up the pubs, we need to do this. So I'd say, specifically because her field is epidemiology and she's been completely consistent, that she must get it. Best Remainer.
Best Remainer. I think, again, I'm hesitating because I don't think he's on this list, but I have to say Matthew Paris has been very, very good in recent weeks.
Well, Matthew, I heard, has been good. I've not read anything, but there's only one person getting this, and he needs a bigger prize anyway. It's Alistair Haymes, who's a previous guest on this podcast, who's written some brilliant stuff for The Critic, produced some amazing graphs and some incisive analysis, and has been completely, completely brilliant on this issue. So Alistair, well done, mate.
Yeah.
Best remain. And I didn't point this out on Alistair's podcast. I meant to, but I want to say that, again, make that point about the battle lines being redrawn and we have new allies now. And you know, if a Remainer is being brilliant on this issue, then take my hand, brother. We will fight this together. So well done, Alistair. We're very near the end. Head boy and head girl.
Well, head boy and head girl. I can't really look past Hector Drummond, head boy, and I would say Laura Perrins for head girl. I mean, Laura has been almost brutally relentless, I have to say, throughout all of this. That there are some people who, you know, try and display some sort of insight and witticism on Twitter. No, she's just taken a sledgehammer to it and made her feelings very, very clear. So I would say they are standing head and shoulders above everyone else.
Well done, Laura. I have to agree, Laura, you've been absolutely fantastic, and I'd love to have you on the podcast, and I'm going to try and endeavour to get you on. So I think that's basically it for our reports. Well done, everybody who won prizes. Honourable mentions, obviously, we've got Carbon Mike, Gaz Conway, who's been very vociferous on Twitter. I don't think he sort of has a media career to speak of, but he's been, by Jove, he's been very consistent. Any other honourable mentions you want to go on before we finish?
Well, I think we've probably covered all of the main players, particularly on the sort of sound side. I think you know, again, aside from the opportunity just to make humorous jokes often at people's expense, which has been one of the highlights of doing the list, it is quite clear to me that you know, this whole period has been an opportunity for people just to force through their narrative. So again, if you look at the sort of lefty list, you know, the likes of Owen Jones and Ash Sarkar, you know, they've effectively used this as an opportunity to ramp up their left-wing sort of militant arguments. You know, the likes of Alistair Campbell and Adam Bolton have used it to push their sort of, I guess you would say, statist technocratic agenda. And then there are people like, well, Piers Morgan, obviously, probably Kay Burley as well, who just use it to push their own ego. So I think really, when you look at it, it's just another opportunity for people to squeeze through their agenda. And I don't see that going away anytime soon. So I think the list in general has been a useful opportunity to hold that mirror up to some people.
Well, I'd like to second that point, actually, and expand a little bit on best publications, because or platforms, because obviously Sky News has been horrendous. Good Morning Britain obviously hosts Piers Morgan, so what are you doing? But there has been some brilliant publications that are decidedly mainstream. I'm going to single out two for special praise. They've been Unheard and The Critic. The Critic obviously has been hosting a lot of writing from new writers, and Unheard, with their lockdown TV and the interviews they've been doing with epidemiologists around the world, and to their credit and to their skill, they managed to get Neil Ferguson on, who obviously the statements he made have been proved to be a complete embarrassment in the weeks since that interview. Like, he said that the Swedish death rate was going to shoot up. Well, it hasn't, so, you know, fuck you, Neil. I think, you know, Freddie Sayers is doing a brilliant job getting some of these epidemiologists on, because it's really opened up the debate and brought this, you know, I don't want to use the word the science, but can I say, like, the research and the people who do this for a living, to people, you know, on their laptops, and he's brought it out in a way everyone can understand. And another thing I like to mention about the bad publications. So Alex Wickham at BuzzFeed, he was the first to break Neil Ferguson's modelling, and you know, without checking that it was peer reviewed, without stating that it was just public projections, they weren't sure that it was right. And without establishing Ferguson's record, which, as we said, is appalling. And likewise, Joe did that infamous re-edit of Boris's words, where they made it seem like Boris was saying that everyone should just let the, we should just let the virus run through and take it on the chin. Whereas we know in actual fact that's kind of more or less what we should have done, because there would have been less deaths that way. And both of those publications have gone down in the last week or so. So like the Scorpion and the Frog, Joe and BuzzFeed being the Scorpion, they have stung the Frog, which is the British Economy, and now they've both drowned. And as they're gasping for air, and the Economy, the Frog, is saying, why do you do that? They can just say, it's our nature. So, you know, and I don't want to dismiss those publications, because obviously there might be some cool people working for them, but do you know what? If you behave so disgracefully in perverting the science, in inverted commas, or scaring the population, then if you go, that's what's going to happen. As simple as that. So Dan, thank you so much for your time. It's been a really great call. And I don't want to rule out the possibility of doing another one actually in a few weeks' time, because your lists might change. And I was slightly time constrained this one, because I had to run back and put my kid to bed. And I feel like we didn't even begin to sort of scratch the surface in many ways. But before I let you go back to your life and your family, let's have, I always do this for every podcast, two to keep the prison theme going, because we are all right now at HMP England, although I have made an escape to Stalag Lift 174. What's your contraband? That's your non-essential item activity that's really kept you going these past few weeks.
Yeah, well, of course, aside from the list itself, which is heavy maintenance, I would say, well, plenty of exercise. I'm going for my frequent run around the country lanes. I've got not a full gym as such, but I've got bits and pieces in the garage, so keeping myself busy. Plenty of things to do outside as well, and the weather, I have to say, has been excellent in the UK. Plenty of alcohol as well, where you can can get hold of it. I mean, that's essential. and in terms of entertainment, a couple of things I've been watching. One is the latest.
This is your watch list. I need to segment these in the correct segments. So what's on your watch list, Dan?
Yes, exactly. My watch list. Well, there's two things right now. One is the current, which I think is season three of Fowder. So anyone who knows James realizes that Fowder gets constantly bigged up, and I enjoyed the first two series. I'm about halfway through series three on Netflix. It's excellent. And what's particularly good about Fowder is that, and I don't know whether you find this, but if you spend a lot of time on Twitter, as you've noticed that I do, you can get so distracted from the plot lines of things and find yourself sort of drifting off. So it's subtitled, because it's, you know, a lot of the dialogue is in, you know, Arabic or Hebrew. So you have to focus. So it's really good for that. So I can highly recommend Fowder.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, because it will help me brush up on my Arabic, which was actually my degree.
Heard you say this, yeah.
It's fallen apart completely. Although I did get to use it a few years ago in a film in Calais. But it's always good to hear it again. And what else? What else have you been up to watching?
Yeah, well, other thing is, and I'm a bit late to the party, but Succession.
Oh, of course.
Which yeah, very, very good. I managed to get hold of I don't currently have Amazon Prime, but I managed to get hold of the DVD of the first season. So really, really good. Sort of like fly on the wall drama of a very, very dysfunctional family, but Very kind of dark humor, really, but excellent. And I was drawn into that because I believe one of the writers of Peep Show is
Yes.
responsible for that. I forget the guy's name, but I'm a
Yeah,
big fan of Peep Show.
Simon Blackwell.
Yeah, I can't remember, but I was a big fan of Peep Show, and it is very different to that, but there's that sort of those sort of humor elements as well. So enjoying both of those right now. But as I say, the weather's so good that I've been outside as much as the state allows me.
Well, actually, I'll recommend something as well. Have you watched Ozark?
No, I haven't, but I've heard a lot about it, and it's that's a Netflix one, isn't it?
Yeah, I definitely recommend it. I got into it, I don't know, maybe a couple of weeks ago and sessioned most of it. It's kind of like it has a Breaking Bad aspect to it, so it's set in these kind of idyllic lakes in Missouri, and it's about sort of normal guy who's found himself drawn into the money laundering for the Mexican cartels,
Right.
and for various plot reasons he ends up doing it around there. And it's Jason Bateman from Arrested Development.
Okay.
You'd think he'd be miscast as a kind of, drug cartel money launderer, but actually he completely nails it. And Laura Linney plays his wife, who I just, in anything she's in, I think she's absolutely fantastic. So it's good to see her as well. So that's another big recommendation from me. So once you've sessioned Fowder, I would recommend heartily that you get onto Ozark.
I shall put it high on the list. Yeah, another list.
So, another, got too many lists, Stan. Serdan, sorry, don't forgive me for getting your title wrong from time to time. So, Dan, if anybody wants to follow you, read you, get in touch, what's the best way?
Well, Twitter. So Sedan of C on Twitter. Send me a message, follow me. As I say, I'm getting a lot of feedback on the lists and things like that. And get in touch.
Well, thanks so much, Dan. Thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been absolute joy. Like I said, I don't think we even scratched the surface of what we could be uncovering, and I'd love to have you on again. Dear listeners, I'm going to keep these going over in Germany, maybe some more beer garden episodes. I've got some, again, I've still got a fantastic guest lined up that you really want to hear. I've got part two of Dr. John Lee. I've got Lucy Harris coming up. I've got Dominic Frisby. I've got Liam Halligan, who said he would do an ep. So I'm really looking forward to getting them all on. And if anybody has any good suggestions of people to that I should have on, let me know. Follow me at Alex Macaroon on Twitter, or there's the email address as podcast, escape from lockdown podcast@gmail.com, and please get in touch. And until then, stay cool, go out, live your life, try and not let this shit get you down. And until next time, bye bye.